Each panelist will share for 10 to 15 minutes. Please help me welcome our first speaker, Michelle.
Hi, everybody. Michelle, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Michelle.
We love you, Michelle.
Lots and lots and lots. Whole bunches. Ugh.
Oh, that's awesome. That's the first time for me. Right in front of all you guys. All right. My sobriety date is 10-3-2002. I'm sorry, 2022. I'm nervous. 2022. Getting sober was not an easy decision. It was not on my radar for many, many years. I never thought about getting sober and really like being sober like forever. No way. Like that was not a thought in my mind. When I started drinking young. I think I had my first cigarette when I was 11. I didn't like that. So that was the last cigarette I ever had. But alcohol was different. That was, that one seemed fun, you know, it gave me the illusion of the fun. And what I later learned is the, letting go of the responsibility, for me, that's what it was. That's what I mean by fun is, reckless fun, you know, just no responsibility, no care in the world for anybody else except me and what made me happy. So getting sober for me looked like truly just like ended relationships when they ended for me. That's what getting sober looked like for me. It wasn't necessarily my family or anything like that. It was that I couldn't hold a relationship with people. Even friends of mine sometimes, like, I wondered why there was such a rift, you know, what the heck is going on here? And I would end up with, in the same cycle of relationships. And so, for me, you know, that was kind of like the turning point of when I started thinking about getting sober. I started realizing how alcohol was affecting, how it was affecting my personal, more romantic, more, to be more like specific, my romantic relationships. It was the same thing. It would start off really fun. It would get a little serious. We start making things and plans, right? Start making moves and moving from one location to another. And then all of a sudden, all of the problems would start coming up and the arguments for nothing. And then waking up and not remembering, but being in this like weird, like what happened yesterday, I'm not sure, but like, let me just smoke this joint and like, it'll be better, you know? And that's the world that I lived in for a long time. And so getting sober was one of the hardest decisions that I made. Thank God I have an older sister who is, she pretty much just tells me what to do. you know, there's no wiggle room. These are the instructions, and, you know, like, if you don't follow them to the T, just like the book says, you know, you're not going to get the outcome. And so she took away my decision-making, and I was okay with that. I was okay with somebody else making the decisions for me, because alcohol had left me in a state where I didn't know what was next. But I knew what was coming, and what was coming was those pretty little bracelets that they don't let you wear in the front. You have to wear them behind you. and like the bracelets are cool, but I always say it's that little chain that hooks them together that really takes your freedom away, you know? And that's where, for me, I drew the line. They've taken my freedom six times. That's hard for me to like admit, you know, like the person that I feel that I am. I've had those pretty little things on six freaking times. And I'm good. I made a decision then that I didn't want that, no matter what relationship I was in. Friendship, romantic relationship, a family member, I'm no good in jail to anybody, including my, like, myself, my friends. I'm no good. I'm no good to anybody in jail. So getting sober for me meant my freedom. You know, more specifically than any relationship, it's just for me, getting sober meant taking back my own freedom. Moving along to just staying sober has been very difficult. Alcohol and other substances have always just been, you know, the filler, so that I didn't have to feel and admit what I was feeling. So I didn't have to go through it with people, so that, you know, like if I had a little thing with you, we'll just go drink and like we'll drink it away, you know. Today, staying sober, it's a little bit different. Showing up is different. Showing up means I have to be present. I have to listen. I can't just talk about myself. That's a big one. I can't just talk about me and what I'm going through and how I saw things. I ask more questions today in order for me to stay sober, because I want to know about you. I have to forget about me. I'm not important anymore. I want to know what's going on in your day. How you're staying sober so that it could help me. I usually hang out like with my nieces and my nephews as a group. And recently, we lost one. Staying sober today over that has been one of the hardest things for me. It's made me, though, a better person, because I've had to take time to take them out individually, get to know them. Be their aunt, Michelle. Explain just how life has been, what maybe they should expect, and just laugh with them and spend that spiritual time with them. I wouldn't be able to do that if I wasn't sober today. If I didn't choose my freedom, I'd be locked up. I'd be locked up while my nephew was missing. Well, we buried him. I'd be locked up to miss the amazing person my niece is. Like, we went ziplining. Like, I know a lot of you don't really know me, but like, me ziplining was not like in the same. Like, it just isn't, you know? It's like jumping out of a plane. Like, why, you know? Like, I don't know, you know? Roller coasters, same thing. Like, good luck, you know? But, you know, she's just an amazing, beautiful person. And today, staying sober means I do those things. And I learn those things by going to meetings. I learn those things, you know, today by listening to the women in my meetings. They tell me what to do. They tell me to go there when I'm uncomfortable. They tell me to go there when I don't want to. They tell me to go there to forget about me and say something for somebody else. It's not about what I take. And I always want to take. What are they going to say today? You know, like, no, raise your hand, Michelle, and say something. Say something for them, you know. Maybe somebody that I idolize, or whatever you call it, look up to. Maybe I have something that they need, you know. Staying sober today means that I started small. I started realizing that maybe I don't treat people the way that I think, you know, as nice as I should, or I think I do. And so I started small, and I started telling myself that I was going to, this is going to sound weird, but like I started with my mom. I started just treating her like I would treat somebody that I would want to date. How would I want to treat them? Well, why don't I treat her that way? And it's changed our relationship. It really has. It's crazy. Like now I go out and she just doesn't even flinch. And before it was like, you know, it's just like little, like those little things for me. That's what has kept me sober. Those little things, those little itty bitty little changes. And it started with me. Living sober today, I don't know, living sober is just waking up every day, you know, thanking God for my life. And asking Him to help me first. That's always first. You know, the second thing I do to live sober today is as soon as I get up, I go and I hug my grandmother. And those things just get me emotional, you know, because those things bring me joy. That's where the joy is. And that's where I want to live today. I used to think that joy was like joyriding, you know, drinking while driving. That was like my favorite thing. You know, I thought that was the joy. You know, it's not. The joy is in really like the little things, the little friendships, the showing up to the dance, and there's like people there that when I opened the door, they cheered for me. That's the joy. That's how I live soberly today. I look for those moments, and I live for those moments, and I'm present for those moments today. So show up, suit up, and think about somebody else. That's how I live sober today. Thank you very much for allowing me to share with you guys today.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Allie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Allie. We love you, Allie. Lots and lots and lots. Whole punches.
So, getting sober for me definitely was not anywhere in my plans. You know, I started drinking at 13. My family is all from Texas, so it's beer in the morning, whiskey in the afternoon. You know, it's just part of their day. So no matter what they're doing, you know, working, whatever, it's just part of it. I grew up with my cousin, you know, full whiskey glass in the center console. Like, that was just part of life. So I always pictured myself, you know, grandma, cut off jean shorts, you know, whiskey on the front porch, and that was just, that's the life that I had planned. I didn't see anything different. And I was totally insane. So, you know, you could text me like, hi, how are you? And I'm like, you know, three sheets to the wind, like, oh my God, they're mad, or this happened and this happened. And I just have these stories in my head, and it was always worst case thinking. So there was no peace ever in my life. You know, always had that feeling of grandiose, but really no self-confidence. So it was very confusing for me growing up. Drinking, pot, any drugs I could find, that was my forte. It got me out of my head. I was able to be selfish, just think kind of, you know, of myself. And I didn't care how that affected my mom, my dad, my brother, my friends. You know, it was always just my will, and that was all. And I grew up going to church, so you would think, you know, I would have some sort of guide, but I didn't. I thought, you know, I go to church, so I'm fine. Like, you know, He'll forgive no matter what, so I can do whatever I want. And, you know, I hurt my mom and my dad all the time. Like Michelle said, you know, they were definitely flinching every time I went out. I was sneaking out. I was lying. I was, you know, doing everything that I wasn't supposed to. And then, you know, in my relationships, it was just everything was their fault. You know, I would immediately go to screaming, yelling, just kind of, you know, well, look at you. You know, you did this to me. And it was never, you know, my fault or my jealousy or my anger. It was never of that, because all of that was warranted in my mind. Definitely wasn't. So for me, I quit my job, just randomly decided, you know what, I hate this, I'm leaving, I'm going to move to Texas, I'm going to be a cowgirl, I'm going to start my life over, and drove out there and was like, I'm going to get sober there too, with the cousin who always has the whiskey in her car, which not a great combination. So a couple of days in, you know, I'm walking down the street to the liquor store and, you know, drinking all day because I'm a morning drinker. I'm a morning, noon, and night drinker. It's just all day, every day. And, you know, smoking weed the whole day too. So after about 2 weeks, I don't know, my other cousin said something, and, you know, he's the kindest guy you'll ever meet. And I took it the wrong way. And I was like, I'm packing up all my stuff and driving home, you know. And, of course, I'd probably been drinking that morning, and I jump in the car with all my stuff, and I leave Texas. And Texas is a really big state. So you're driving, and I'm, like, 5 hours in, and all of a sudden I kind of come to, and I'm like, where the heck am I? It's midnight. I'm calling my boyfriend. I'm like, I don't know where I am in Texas. I'm on my way home, you know, all these things. And he's like, you got to pull over. You got to go to sleep. Like, this is totally insane. So the next day I drive more, and then I finally get home, and my mom's on a trip. You know, she's been traveling all over the world, and she has no idea I'm coming home to her house. So I just show up, and she's out of town, and I'm, you know, back at it. Back drinking in the morning, just drinking all the time. And then another night, I basically got in my car, decided that I was going to go rescue somebody whose phone died, which, you know, normal people, what do you think? Oh, they're going to stop and get a charger. Nope, I'm going to drive up to 74, like maybe flash my brights at him when I see him, you know, just try to like rescue him, right? Not send him off the mountain or whatever. So I get up there, you know, I've been drinking, been taking Xanax, so I'm just a total mess. End up driving back home in the morning, been drinking all night, no sleep, roll my car on the 74 with my dog in there, and just somehow, you know, we survived. My car was totaled. You know, I jump out, and I'm like, oh, my God, there must be angels or something, because these two cars stopped, you know, they were helping me, giving me water, and they're like, you have someone watching over you. Like, we thought we were going to have to pull you out of that car. So, you know, I get arrested, the pretty bracelets, my dog's in the car, you know, I have no leash for him, I have nothing. It's 9 a.m. on a Sunday, the officer's trying to call my mom, and I'm like, she's in church, you know, like, I don't know, you can't reach her. So at like 11, he called her back, and I'm going all the way to Murrieta jail, and she has to come pick me up, and they released me, so I'd have to do a book and release. I get a DUI. I'd gone home that afternoon and tried to drink a margarita, you know, thinking that's going to be the best decision, and didn't get much down, but for the next month, I continued to drink. My boyfriend decided he's going to go to treatment, so I said, I'm going to get sober on the outside with you. So I stopped smoking a couple days in. I'm like, I can't do this. So I start drinking again, and I'm right back to drinking in the morning, and finally stopped and just doing some, like, online sober meetings. They weren't AA or anything. And I'm like, yeah, this is great. I could totally do this, you know. And I was never going to go to an AA meeting. I didn't want to go. You know, I wasn't like everybody else and didn't need meetings. And so I got challenged to go to a meeting. Of course, then I'm like, well, I'm going to prove them wrong, you know, I'm going to go. So I go in with my dog, and, you know, I stayed. And I got involved pretty much right away with Central Office. I got a sponsor within a month. It was not something that I wanted to do, and I still don't always listen to my sponsor when she tells me things to do, because I like to learn the hard way. And, you know, but she's always there for me. You know, she listens. Central Office, David took me right under his wing, you know, telling me, like, you know, hey, you're codependent. You might be, like, all of these, you know. So I've got a whole slew of issues that are going on besides the alcohol, besides the drugs. So it really focused and, like, made me actually look at myself. And it has not been easy because, you know, I went to serving, working at a boutique, and, you know, I was making way more money back when I had, like, a really good job. But that alcohol just made me quit and want to run away because that's kind of my MO, you know. I'm going to run from this, and I'm going to get away, and I'm going to start over, and it's going to be totally different. But it was never different. You know, it's been really humbling the last year, just kind of like taking a step back, but I haven't had to take my job with me when I go home. So it's really given me time to like focus on going to meetings and doing my steps. And I just finished my steps and it feels really good to like have looked at my inventory. Like most people say, oh, the fourth step, I'm dreading that, I'm putting it off. And I'm like, I'm excited. Like, let's look at all my flaws. Let's write them all down. There's a lot of them, you know? And it just helps when, you know, they do pop up because they're still there. They're still strong. But, you know, I can look at them and I can say, oh, I'm starting to go down this path. My sponsor will always ask me, like, well, how many meetings did you go to this week? You know, and I'm like, only one or two. And she's like, well, maybe you're not going to enough. And I do find that when I don't go to, you know, at least 3 to 4 meetings a week, like, my impatience pops up. All my issues pop back up, you know, and it's just having that kind of community around you that, you know, supports you, and really taking the time to listen. And this year has been really tough. So living sober is not like, you know, all rainbows. It hasn't been super easy. You know, I'm going through a lot of other issues, but I can go through them with more peace. So I say the Serenity Prayer, and I've said this from pretty much the minute I got sober. You know, angry driver, that's also one on my checklist, you know. So I would just say the Serenity Prayer every time someone would cut me off or someone would do something stupid, instead of, you know, flipping them off and driving aggressively, you know, it's just, oh yeah, I can't control that. So like, why let that ruin my day? And so there's just a lot of patience that has come with it. And, you know, my mom and I's relationship has just gotten way better. And, you know, she tells me all the time, she's like, I don't know how you came out of me because you are so opposite. She's like, you know, I'm very tall, she's very short, she's from Texas, you know, very good girl, like never really did drugs, like never, you know, snuck out, nothing. Like, she's just a great human. And here I am, just, you know, Tasmanian devil spiraling through her life. And she's like, I just don't get it. But, you know, now it's like I've been able to communicate to her, like, how my mind works and all these different things. And she's, you know, she's my best friend. Like, I'm so thankful that I live close to her and, you know, we can have a relationship. And, I mean, I'm not perfect. There's no way. But at least I can be honest with her about, like, my life and what I'm doing. And even my dad, like, I never had a good relationship with my dad. You know, he always told me what to do, and I can just talk to him now, and when he goes on for 20 minutes about the gas prices where he is and his motorhome and, you know, all these different things that I have zero care about, you know, I can just sit there and listen and have patience with him and, you know, love him for who he is. And it's really nice. My brother, I have no relationship with him for kind of a crazy reason. And I was able to, you know, write him an amends, him and his wife. And, you know, they never responded, but I'm at peace with that because, you know, I've done my part and I've, you know, accepted what I've done wrong. And, you know, I'm not saying that he's perfect either, but I can still love him for who he is. And I can have a relationship with my nephews at least. And he's my only sibling, so that's really important to have my nephews and have that relationship. So I'm not saying it's easy, but my life is definitely more peaceful, even with all the ups and downs of, you know, life being life. So, thank you.
Hi, I'm Rory. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Rory.
Lots and lots. Whole lunches.
I love that. So, if newcomers could see no joy in our existence, they wouldn't want it. We absolutely insist on enjoying life, and Dickie Paw has given me a bit of that joy in my life. We are absolutely not a glum lot, and we call back at everything, and we hoot and we holler, and we try to have fun in recovery. I'm really, really grateful for my sponsor's direction in that one a few years ago. The gist of that, just real quick before I dive into the topic, was in an inventory, I think it was like my second round, he asked, you know, like, he pointed out that, you know, when you start drinking, you kind of stunt your emotional growth at that point, right? And I was so resistant to this idea that I was a 20-something-year-old with the brain of a 14-year-old. It's like, I'm so mature for my age, and all this thing. Inner temper tantrum, and he suggested Dickie Pie. He's like, I know you've mentioned YPAW meetings before, but like maybe get connected. And at the time, my sobriety date's March 17th, 2020. I'm a product of the pandemic. Got sober on a screen the day we went into lockdown and haven't looked back since. So Dickie Pie struggled during that transition period of Zoom and how to keep meetings going and all that jazz. And so it was a really solid opportunity to go be of service in an arena that I was entirely unfamiliar with. And I am so freaking grateful that that happened. Young people still scare the crap out of me. And so they just do. They're always so talking about things like being lit and whatever. I don't know. I found my tribe, and I found people that love me and that I can aspire to be more like, and I can learn from and grow with. And I'm really, really grateful for Desert City's Young People of Alcoholics Anonymous. Getting sober. So getting sober during a pandemic. just some background, you know, alcohol was my first love for sure. I definitely graduated to harder and harder substances. I qualify in a lot of programs. I've worked the steps in multiple programs, including the Green and Gold in CODA. I'm most certainly an adult child of an alcoholic. Like, I belong in anywhere where somebody's going to be talking about their crazy at a podium. I'm like, oh yeah, my people. Yeah, I can relate. And, I came into the rooms homeless. I got really, really sick in February. We had a looming lockdown, right? We saw on TV and we saw in the news that the world was going to be told to go to their room at some point, but we didn't really know what that was going to look like. And the people that I surrounded myself with, half of them could care less and they just wanted to get high or get drunk. And the other half were absolutely paranoid, peeking out the windows, like, the police are going to come and tell us to lock down. And it was not a very fun place. And during that time, I got really, really sick. I had an upper respiratory infection, and I took somebody hostage by staying on his couch for a week with like 100-something-degree fever. Not my first, but an aha moment of powerlessness was the fact that despite being bedridden and like congested and having no energy to do anything, I was still chasing a high in those moments. I would get up to go to the bathroom, not to eat, but to go and hit the pipe. That was my existence. And it still wasn't quite enough, but it was my first like realization, like, I got to change something. And I got a little bit better. I didn't know if it was COVID or whatnot, that the hospitals weren't testing for it. But I remember finally having this like sliver of willingness to do something about it, and somebody suggested I call the 211 number, which is the county helpline for public resources. And as what I learned as like a young 20-something-year-old cisgendered white male with no kids and no veteran status, like, there's not a readily available resource like, yes, here's your golden ticket. It's more work. Like, gotta call this program every day, and I didn't have that much willingness. And I think my higher power knew that. I was on the phone with this woman, and she rushes me off the phone, and she said, I gotta call you back. And I can hear commotion in the background, and now I'm like panicking. And she calls me back, and she said, look, she's kind of laid it out for me. Like, you have nowhere to go, nowhere to be, and we are going into lockdown tonight. So we don't know what that means. We don't know if police are going to be rounding people up. We don't know what that's going to mean for shelters, but like, you need to get to a hospital or a shelter ASAP, because we didn't know. We had no fucking clue what lockdown meant, right? I was sick. I'm HIV positive, and I wasn't on my medications, so I was at high risk for COVID. That's what we believed at the time. And we didn't know what transmission would look like in a public setting, so I opted for the hospital. And hospitals terrified me in my addiction, because I always felt like they're going to be on to me, and I had paranoia issues, so I didn't know that. And but I did something like we call it sober feet today, where like I align myself with something greater than me that does the next right thing. And I heard her instruction to go to the hospital, and I did the thing, which
had the recipe of desperation and opportunity not been like just right, that would not have happened. And I moseyed on into the hospital, where they didn't do anything, by the way. They just like put me to bed and tested me for all these things. They're like, oh yeah, you have all of these substances. And they're like, pull out this receipt in your system. And like, they didn't do shit about it. They didn't test for COVID, but told me to go get tested. They kept me overnight until the wee hours of the morning, and then they released me. And I slept on a park bench, and that was the last night that I spent on a bench, because the next morning I got a call from the county saying they were going to put me in a hotel. They were putting homeless people in hotels. And I spent my first 6 months of my recovery at the Musicland Hotel, this tweaky-ass little janky motel in Palm Springs, where I had done all kinds of nefarious things in that place. And I was getting sober in there. To be completely frank, this came up yesterday at a meeting I was at. The topic was powerlessness and unmanageability, and it reminded me of my first decision to consider sobriety. I was a joy to be around when we were drinking, because I always thought, like, I always knew, like, this is not the life that I was meant to have, right? This life of getting in the car and waking up in front of my old house an hour away, not knowing how I got there, but like somehow traversing the 710 from West Hollywood to Long Beach at some point. It was missing Thanksgiving because I was scrounging through the shag carpet looking for shards to put in a pipe. You know, like, that's, I knew my life was better than that. And I remember sharing that a fair amount, and people didn't really like killing their high, so I wasn't exactly fun to be around when I was doing that. But when I really considered recovery was when I got into that room, and I had a backpack that, I mean, it was a homeless person's backpack. There was like some pennies and some empty liquor bottles and maybe a half empty bottle of butane or some shit. It was just tweaker nonsense. But I had a phone. I had a phone charger. I also had a laptop, because I thought school at one point was going to save me. But I had the school. I had a laptop, and I text my friend, who, he's kind of my Eskimo, and he was somebody that I was intimate with over the last 2 years that I used with daily. He had gone off in January of 2020 and got sober, and I messaged him, and I don't know if the intention was for me to ask him for help to get sober or to do the thing, but I said, they put me in a hotel. What are you doing? And he's like, I'm going to a meeting. And I was like, that's funny. Like, we're in lockdown. How are you doing that? And he sent me like a Zoom link. So getting sober meant going to 4, 5, 6 meetings a day for my first year, because I could. I mean, meetings were like this big, but that's what we did. I don't remember exactly what I heard in that meeting, but the feeling I got was that everybody in that meeting was struggling to accept the circumstances that the entire world was just given, right? Which is, your meeting schedule's about to change, fellowship may go away, economic fear, right? Fear of our family and our loved ones. It was the great equalizer. And like, I heard bits and pieces of my story as well, but people were really concerned with how we were going to get from one day to the next. And it was the first time where I felt like, oh my God, I'm not alone, you know? And we all went through that. I'm so grateful for the alcoholics and the addicts who put together Zoom platforms for me, because I'm here because of those people, right? Because they took it upon themselves to be selfless and to be of service while also safeguarding their sobriety and making it happen. I heard the message. I heard various messages. Staying sober my first year, again, it just meant going to a ton of meetings. It meant finding a sponsor. And the beauty in Zoom is that I could find a sponsor that didn't live in my locale. She lived in Laguna Beach. I picked a woman sponsor because, as a gay man, I didn't trust other men. My relationships with other men were very transactional, very situationship-y. And it was all about an exchange. So like, and that's total projection, because I used men, and so therefore they must be wanting to use me as well. And so I picked a female sponsor, and she worked me through the steps. I got to step three, and I remember having this really, you know, candid conversation with her about, I don't think I can do this. Like, I believe the God thing works for some people, but I don't think I can take that leap of faith and truly believe that something greater than myself could restore me to sanity, and that I am willing to let it, right? Bless her, Cynthia Ellis. She was one of the most wonderful human beings ever. One of the things I did to stay engaged in meetings, I had a deck of tarot cards because tweaker bag, and I would pull cards to find the meaning of the card in meetings. That's how I paid attention for a while. That and like fidgety, I have a recovery brace anklet that I wear today, but like fidgety things like that just to kind of stay engaged. And she broke it down. She's like, okay, so when you shuffle the deck, like, are you putting them in any specific order, or like, are you turning it over? I was like, yeah, I guess. And she's like, and how much faith do you put in the card that comes up for you? I was like, well, it's as much as I want. She's like, yeah, that sounds pretty 1, 2, and 3 to me. Okay, all right. And that was like my entryway. And that's not my conception of something greater than myself today, but it was the right recipe of verbiage, right, for an alcoholic like me who can do all the mental gymnastics in the world to get around the God thing. It worked. It showed me that this concept of something greater than myself is exactly that. It is of my own choosing that I get to build my version of a relationship with today. And it's transformed over the years so much, and it's such a beautiful thing that it has. I heard in my early recovery too that my concept of something greater than myself needed to be able to access it quicker than I could access a drink. And so I couldn't go run for my cards and pull a tarot card. So I had to like think on how to develop this concept. My sponsor also asked that in the third step with all this resentment you have around the G word. She suggested I pull out some paper and some colored pencils and like draw out my higher power with all the qualities that my higher power has. And leave out the rest of that. When I close my eyes and I hear the G word in a meeting, I picture the thing that I drew out, right? And it was really, really helpful. It just further enforced that thing of my own creation. We got to a fourth step, and we did an inventory, and I had a surprisingly simple or easy time getting through the inventory. I knew my life has so much shock value. That's the ego. That was how like I felt about writing the inventory. I'm going to scare her, right? Like there's going to be a lot of things that she's never even, oh man, I was so looking forward to it. I was a newcomer with a big ego, and, it was fine. She had no judgment, no response to anything until she said, all right, now we're going to do an assets inventory. I could tell you all of the things that Rory disliked about Rory. But telling you all of the positive things that I carry into this world was a very foreign concept to me. I bring this up because it ties into my living sober today. For every defect of character that came up through my inventory and we wrote out in preparation for 6 and 7, she had me write out an asset. And it was difficult. I could not look in the mirror and say that Rory is a kind human being or that Rory puts the needs of others first, because I was in survival mode. Of course I had to come first. It kept me alive out in homelessness, right? She walked me through it, everything short of holding my hand and writing out the word for me. And by the end of it, I had this honest belief that Rory at his core is an honest person and is a gentle human being and loves the world around him and is appreciative of the people who have done this thing before him. We got to 6 and 7, and I again struggled with the mental gymnastics of the God thing, but it really was simple. She said, if you can't get on your knees and pray, what action can you take? And the action for me, prayer is intention, right? It's God grant me, help guide me in my recovery. Thy will be done, not mine. Right, it's an intention, and so it was suggested that I follow that through with an action. So if I am looking for willingness, then I have to practice willingness, and if I'm looking to be honest, then I get to practice honesty, and I take action to do so. I built a gratitude practice in that 3, 4, or 4, 5, 6, 7 process. Where it was explained to me that the difference between gratitude and being thankful is observations. I don't typically have to put a lot of work into things that I'm thankful for, but being grateful is a two-way street. I put work into things that I'm grateful for. I'm grateful for this recovery because I fought tooth and nail to keep my seat in these rooms. I'm grateful for the relationships I have with my family because I got to make direct amends and have a relationship with those family members. I am grateful for the air that I breathed today because there were so many times where I woke up or where I went to sleep hoping I wouldn't wake up in the morning, or that oncoming traffic would just veer off a little bit. I was too chicken shit to do anything about it, but I was really hoping that something would happen to me. I'm still kind of fingers crossed for a meteor, but that's another topic. When we got to 8 and 9, you know, 8's just making the list. And then becoming willing, you know, I struggled with the becoming willing part of things. There was one particular amends that I wasn't capable of making until 4 years into my sobriety. And it was the person that I was with when I made the decision to become a professional alcoholic addict, where I was drinking and using on the daily. And it ended this relationship. I gave up my relationship for booze and boys. And he was the last amends that I had to make. Not the last, but the significant amends that my first sponsor said, yeah, you don't get to do that. We're going to hold off on that one. To do so could injure them or others, right? And he was in a loving, committed relationship that we had reason to believe that if I were to approach him could cause harm. And so we put that one away for a while. As long as Rory was willing, then the universe would present an opportunity. And I wavered with that because he started coming back into my life in very odd ways, whether it was just reaching out, social medias, reminders, Facebook memories is a bitch, but, you know, just the things were coming up. And earlier this year, he had reached out and asked if we could meet up and have coffee, and that was, like, my cue. I got to work with my sponsor, and my first understanding of making amends was righting my wrongs, so to speak, right? Saying this is what I did, and then changing the behavior so that I don't do it again, right? In Alcoholics Anonymous, we even go as far as to ask, you know, what can I do to right this? With time, I came to understand, and it was told to me that I'm not making amends for the actions, I'm making amends for the behaviors, for the exact nature of my wrongs. So I pushed him in an argument, right? I laid hands on him. The exact nature of that is I harmed him. I physically harmed him. You know, I stayed out till 3 o'clock in the morning. I snuck into bed. I'm high as a kite, and I can't go to sleep, and I'm pretending to be asleep. I'm not going to bring all of that up. I was dishonest. I was manipulative, and I cheated. And we get down to the exact nature as to not cause more harm by making the amends than the harm we had already caused. And I had to sit in step 8 with that for a little while because he reached out to me. My sponsor suggested that if the opportunity presents itself, then so be it, take it. But you don't get to force Rory's will into this situation. You don't get to, thanks for asking me to coffee. I have a lot to tell you. and the opportunity I'm really grateful did present itself where, conversation was casual. He just wanted to catch up. And I asked him if I let him know that as part of my program, I would like to make some amends for some things. And I got to make amends for being physically abusive, for lying, for being manipulative, and causing extreme and genuine worry. At different points in my disease, he reached out to my family asking how I was doing. He went as far one time to try and come and rescue me from a crack house. Like, the amount of fear that I must have instilled in another human being for them to risk jeopardizing their own safety is, like, to me today, it's incomprehensible. So I got to make amends for those 4 or 5 things. And then my sponsor suggested that I ask if there was anything that I missed. And he had questions. We got to talk it out. And I didn't get to be tied to the outcome. And the outcome was perfect. We parted ways with this levity that sense of peace. Like, God really did for me what I couldn't do for myself and put this person back in my life in that moment so that I could get all of this off my chest. For the last four years at that point, it was something that, like, it took up a lot of space, being it, like, which is kind of like teetering in and out of the willingness in step 8, like, how can I make this amends? And it was Rory's will versus God's will and making the amends, and it happened at the right time, the perfect time. If I had any less sobriety or any less spirituality than I did in that moment, it could have gone a completely different direction. Step 10 takes me to kind of this living sober. 10, 11, 12, I was taught that it's never too soon to start working those because it kind of gets me out of self. 10, I'm really grateful. At month 3, I moved into a sober living and we had 10-step worksheets. So I had a really good understanding of, like, taking my inventory. And again, it kind of reinforced that fourth step assets column, because in this 10-step worksheet that was given to me by the Sober Living, it was, what did you do today that you would like to do more of tomorrow? Like, what would you, or I forget how to word it, but basically what were my wins for today, right? Because that's, I get to take a look at the whole picture, right? I had some very, very fun 10-step moments where, like, I chewed out a deli lady at Ralph's in Palm Springs, and, like, I was so in the right, by the way. And at least that's how I felt in the moment. And call my sponsor, and she's like, well, why are you walking away from the Ralph's? Your amends is that way. And promptly, you know, I got to make the – I had to go back and make the amends and, like, own up for it. Like, I did so kicking and screaming, but I did it. And I'm so grateful for those valuable lessons, because I got to instill those on sponsees, you know, where somebody said, oh, I'm not really happy with how I treated this person. And I was like, okay, what's the footwork we can put into this situation, and how can we find this complete stranger that they may never see again? And we came up with a way that they may be able to track this person down and make a direct amends. And I had an experience where I had to do the same thing. 11, my spiritual practice. I am not a hit the knees in the morning kind of human being, or silent meditation. It still does not come easy to me. But I do start my day with gratitude, a gratitude practice. And for me, that just means sitting in silence and then making my bed. I love on my animals. I take them out a little bit, and I just start my day with peace, because we have a two-part primary purpose, which is to stay sober and then to help another alcoholic achieve sobriety. And I'm no good to the world if I'm not taking care of me first. Practicing my principles, these principles in all of my affairs. Some days it's easy. Some days it's difficult. I have a lot of what I've learned in a very, very recent inventory is that I have a lot of expectations of the world around me. You should be honest. You should communicate these things. You should. And I've been bitter about it. I've gotten periods in my sobriety where, like, I was stagnant and taking everybody's inventory that walked into a room. You know, they're doing it wrong. These newcomers don't know what it was like. And, I share about it. I learned a lot of really, really important lessons in my early recovery. The most important one, one of the most important ones, that, you know, COVID being the great equalizer, I saw people who, first, it was huge if you had more than 30 days without anything in your system, right, to get through life and just kind of raw dog it. But I was watching people with decades of sobriety go out. I learned that relapse is not part of recovery. It's part of the disease, and it does not have to be part of my story. And that lesson was followed immediately by, I do not have to put my hand to the fire to know it's hot. Like, it's all these, like, AA bumper stickers and stuff like that I really hold true to my heart. One of the most important ones is, like, yeah, we heard it in a meeting recently. It was, a smart man learns from his mistakes, but a wise man learns from other people's mistakes, right? Like, I watched people go out, and I watched people claw their way back into their rooms and hold onto their seat for dear fucking life. And those are the people that I hold closest to me, because I watch those people battle the shame and the guilt that they felt coming back into the rooms after they lost their time and reclaimed their seat and walked through with humility, staying sober. I watched people do half measures and go into a program and think, well, I never had a problem with pot, so I think I can stay here. Like, Alcoholics Anonymous is okay. After years of being in recovery, and I watch those people struggle. The worst examples are the people who made the conscious decision to step away from the program, and their life did not immediately and completely fall apart. Like, oh my God, those are dangerous people for me today. I am so fucking grateful for my first and my second sponsor, who, like, drilled it into my head that I do have an allergy. Like, I start and I cannot stop. I would start and I would end up using behind a trash can of a Motel 6 with whoever decides to walk by that day. I'd be contemplating jumping off of the bridge by the old KFC right there. It's not a very high bridge. It'd probably just break a leg or something like that. But, like, that was my version of, like, taking my life. That's where my life would take me. I've seen my story, and I've heard my story in the rooms enough, and I've watched people with my experience go out and not come back enough times that I know without a shadow of a doubt that would not be me. I would not be able to pick up and maintain my life that I have today. And I love my life today. I fucking love it. It's scary. I'm so grateful that my problems are Cadillac problems today. It's things like worrying what time my boyfriend's going to call me tonight, you know, if I'm the first person he calls when he lands, or if I'm the second person, like just me trying to control things again. But like that, those are my issues today. I wouldn't trade those issues for anything. Living sober is being of service for me. It's saying yes to the AA commitments. It's having a sponsor who has a sponsor that I meet with regularly. It's having sponsees. It's picking up the phone when they call, even when I don't want to, mostly when I don't want to. And, yeah, suiting up and showing up. Thank you for both of your stories. Like, I have three nephews today that will never know me loaded. I have a brother who said yes to the gift of recovery last year, and he's doing the thing. I have a dad who's sober, who I lean on. You know, I definitely grew up in a home, or like in an environment where like you got up and you had a beer, and then you went to the bar at lunch, and then you went to the bar after work, and like that was just life in our small town. I did not see sobriety as being accessible for me, and I'm so fucking grateful that those people in the early days of the pandemic said that I could get this if I wanted it. So thanks for hearing me ramble. I think we've got some time here, but I'm going to pass it over to Allie. Thanks.
I'm going to pass it to Michelle.